True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
This is Investigator Rob Hemmert with the Seminole County Sheriff's Office. The person being interviewed is Angela, and the last name is Brandt.
It was January 3rd, 1971.
Charlie was 13?
Yes.
And Angela, you were how old?
15.
Tell me again what took place and what was going on.
9:10 p.m.
Okay.
We had just gotten a color TV.
Right.
So we were all sitting around watching the FBI, you know, Effins and Bliss Jr. and all that.
Okay.
FBI was over. We went upstairs. I went and got in bed to read my book like I always did before I went to sleep.
Okay.
My mom ran a bath and read Time magazine. My dad was shaving.
Okay. So you're in your bed reading, and what happens next?
I heard loud noises, which I perceived to be firecrackers.
Okay.
For the simple reason, not that that makes any sense.
That's all right.
But, I mean, you know, I just,
sure.
What other loud noise is there?
Popping.
Yeah, just a really loud noise. And I just, like I said, I just thought it was firecrackers. So I started pulling the covers back to see why on earth, you know, there was all this noise going on. But then I heard my father yell, Charlie, don't, or Charlie, stop. And my mom was just screaming, and the last thing I ever heard my mom say was, Angela, call the police.
So what happens after that?
So, as I said, I was removing the covers from my bed and getting out of the bed, and all this took place in split seconds.
Okay.
I mean, this has got to be less than a minute, I would think, okay?
Right.
And I get up, and as I'm getting up, he comes into my room.
Charlie.
Okay. Brandishing the gun, a gun. I didn't even realize what it really was. I mean, until he aimed it at me, and he pulled the trigger.
Okay, so you hear it click.
I could hear it click.
Okay.
And I guess when he realized the gun didn't have any more bullets, that must be what he threw it on the floor. And as I said, I was lucid enough to kick it under the bed. I didn't know if it had any bullets in it or not. I don't even know what was going on.
Right.
And then a physical altercation ensued. I imagine, I think he struck me. I do. I think he, because I had blood and just bruises, and I fought back. This is the only physical altercation I've ever been in my entire life.
Okay.
And I guess I won because I'm here to tell about it. I don't know.
Right.
And my brain, I remember I was only 15. My brain was trying to assimilate what was going on, and I was trying to get away from him at the same time. He was very strong. Next thing I know that I can remember is I was laying flat on my back. My bed was right here.
On the bed?
No, on the floor.
Okay.
Probably he knocked me to the floor. I don't know.
Okay.
And he was sitting on me, and he was strangling me.
Okay.
I was drifting in and out. I don't think that I got him off of me physically.
All right.
The way I remember it is I saw the weird look on his face, the madness, the glazed over look.
Okay.
I saw it disappear. He just looked more like himself, and he said, what am I doing? Or what have I done? And I remember perfectly saying, I don't know, but I think you shot Dad. Because I heard my dad yelling, Charlie, don't do that, or Charlie, stop. And he said, oh, I did, or whatever. I said, I don't know, but get off of me so we can figure it out, okay? And he did. He got off of me. My next step, I was trying to get out of the house. He goes, sir, you're not going to leave me, are you? Of course. I said, no.
Sorry.
No, I would run out the door. And I did. As soon as I thought he was far enough away, I ran. Have you ever seen Texas Chainsaw Massacre?
Yeah.
I saw it once in my life. I could never watch it again. You know the girl screaming?
Yeah.
The way she ran screaming? That was me. I was just a little girl. I was running through the snow in my bloody nightgown, torn, screaming.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
After this episode of True Crime Brewery, check out the Time Suck podcast. The Time Suck podcast explores true crime, history, the paranormal, and more. Host Dan Cummins deep dives into topics like shadow people, Ted Bundy, and Vlad the Impaler, with some dark humor and intense research. This week, Dan looks at Pedro Lopez, the monster of the Andes, a serial killer thought to have murdered 350 people. Listen to Time Suck wherever you listen to podcasts. TimeSuck podcast.com.
Every hour in the United States, 75 people are reported missing. What if there is a task force dedicated to bringing them home? That's the story behind the new original drama Gone, premiering February 27th on WGN America. It stars Chris Noth and Danny Pino, as well as newcomer Levin Ramin. She portrays the newest member of this elite team, who herself is a survivor of a childhood abduction. Don't miss the series premiere of Gone, Wednesday, February 27th, at 9 Eastern, 8 Central, on WGN America.
In 1971, 13-year-old Charlie Brandt shot his pregnant mother to death before turning the gun on his father and his sister. In the years that followed, he seemed to move forward and live a pretty normal life with college, marriage, and a career. Charlie and his wife Terry were a very close, fun-loving couple, the kind that other couples would envy. Then, in 2004, his hidden life was revealed. Charlie was not who he appeared to be. There was a darkness no one had seen. But there had been signs. Charlie loved to fish, and he was known to his fellow fishermen as an expert with a knife. But Charlie's expertise went way beyond the world of filleting fish. After his death, Charlie would be investigated as a prolific serial killer, victimizing women along the Florida coast. He had a sexual obsession with his niece that would end in her brutal murder. Join us at the quiet end today for a fascinating story of a killer undercover, the hidden life of Charlie Brandt.
Today's beer is a beer from Miami. It's called It Was All a Dream, and it's brewed by Jay Wakefield Brewing. And it's a stout. I know. I slipped. But I couldn't resist. This is their basic stout, aged in bourbon maple syrup barrels with coffee, coconut, and vanilla. And just to make this a fairly short, concise review, it tastes exactly like that description. Maple syrup, coffee, coconut, vanilla, chocolate. All the flavors are there. They all work really well together. This is an absolutely phenomenal beer. I'm looking forward to drinking some more when we hit Florida again.
Yes, not too far in the future. Well, let's open it up.
Okay.
Dick, come join me here at the quiet end. Not many people around, but some friendly faces.
Yeah, we see the same crew time and again.
Yep. Nice but people.
Nice to have them around.
Yes.
Jim Graves was a friend of Charlie Brandt, and he happened to be married to Charlie's sister, Angela. He will never forget the day Angela told him a deep, dark secret about her brother. But Jim felt like he knew his brother-in-law. And if there were signs of anything amiss, he would explain them away as mere eccentricities. The truth is, even if someone you know was a serial killer, you would probably have no idea. There's a separation between the public's version of a serial killer as a monster and the reality of an average-looking person who commits heinous crimes against humanity.
It's true. People just think that a serial killer looks a certain way, but this story will really illustrate that it isn't that way.
Yeah, right. I can tell a mile away which one's a serial killer.
Yeah, right.
But the terrifying truth is that serial killers usually look and act like everyone else. And none of us wants to believe that. We want them to be so obviously different in appearance and mannerisms that they're easily discovered.
Sure, we do.
But that is part of what allows serial killers to be successful and repeat their crimes without being caught. They look just like you and me.
Right. And that's how this guy got away with it for so long. Charlie and Angela's parents had immigrated to America from Germany. Herbert Brandt got an engineering job at International Harvester in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and they began raising a family. Angela was born first and then Charlie. Their younger siblings came along a few years later. Charlie was remembered as a shy and chubby kid who really didn't have any friends in school and got picked on a lot. The family took vacations down in Florida. They stayed at the Coral Sands in Ormond by the Sea, and Herbert decided to take the 12-year-old Charlie hunting with him. The only friend Charlie really had at the time was the family dog, who was a beagle, and they took the dog with them on this hunting trip. So the story that Jim heard was that Herbert shot the dog on that trip. Jim was thinking maybe Charlie shot the dog, maybe his rage was there early on and he took it out on the family pet. We know that serial killers are known to be abusive to pets. But Herbert said he didn't mean to shoot the dog, but he did it. He was just trying to scare the dog out of the bushes and accidentally hit the dog. When the vacation was over, they went back up to Fort Wayne, and the shooting happened a week after they got back from vacation. And this is the shooting of Charlie's mother that I'm talking about here.
Yeah, it had me confused for a minute there.
Yeah. Charlie was an introvert, and his dad had shot his best friend down in Florida, his dog. So that was the story, that Charlie's dad had shot the dog, and maybe that's what set Charlie off when he shot at his family. Maybe Herbert, Charlie's father, wanted to make a man out of Charlie and teach him a lesson. We don't know.
What we do know is that on Sunday, January 3rd, 1971, there was an ice storm in Fort Wayne. Angela Brandt lived with her parents, Ilsa and Herbert, her brother Charlie, and her two little sisters, Melanie and Jessica. Angela was 15, Charlie 13. Jessica 3, Melanie was just 2, and Ilsa was 8 months pregnant with the family's fifth child. It was 9 or 10 o'clock in the evening. The family had just gotten a color TV that day. So Ilsa scolded Charlie about getting his homework done, and their parents went upstairs to the bathroom. Herbert was shaving at the bathroom mirror. Ilsa was reading a Time magazine as she took a bath. Jessica and Melanie were in bed in the bedroom right behind Angela's.
Angela was reading a book in her bedroom when she heard loud noises that she thought were firecrackers. Then she heard, "Charlie, no," or "Charlie, don't," and she heard her mom screaming. Her mom called out to her, "Angela, call the police." So she was just pulling the covers off to get out of her bed. But within seconds, Charlie came into her room carrying a handgun, and she didn't realize what it was right away until he aimed it at her and pulled the trigger. She heard the gun click, and Charlie realized that the gun didn't have any more bullet, so he threw it on the floor. Angela kicked it under the bed, and then Charlie physically attacked her. She was bruised and she was bleeding, and she fought back. The next thing she knew, she was on the floor at the foot of her bed, and Charlie was on top of her. He was strangling her. She saw a strange look on his face, she would say, which she described as a glazed-over look. When he looked more like himself, he said, "What did I do?" And Angela answered, "I don't know, but I think you shot Dad."
So this is like he's in some kind of a fugue state, you know?
Yeah, he could have been pretending or it could have been real.
Right.
We don't know.
This is Angela's recollection.
Yes. Horrifying night for her, of course.
Yeah. Well, she knew she had to get out of the house if she wanted to survive.
Sure.
"I think you've killed or done something to Mom and Dad," she told Charlie. "I think we ought to go downstairs." Now, the only reason she wanted to go downstairs was to get out of the house and get help. So she made up a story. This was the early 70s, and she said to Charlie, "We'll run away and join a hippie commune." Charlie said, "Well, okay." Angela had to get him away from her so she could open the front door and get outside. So she told Charlie, "It's very cold outside. You need to go upstairs and get a blanket for Melanie and Jessica." So she just wanted to get out of the house. Charlie began to walk up the stairs backwards. He was saying, "Angie, if I go up here, you're not going to leave me, are you?" Angela said, "No, of course not." But as soon as he was far enough away, she bolted out the front door.
Yeah, she tore away in her bloody nightgown, barefoot in the snow, and she was running to neighbors' houses trying to get help. No one answered the door at the first two houses. Then she ran to the next house, and by that time Charlie was outside too, and Angela could hear him screaming, "Angie, you promised you wouldn't leave me, you promised." So Angela said that she finally burst into a neighbor's house without knocking, and the family was playing cards. And Angela screamed, "I think Charlie killed my mom and dad." Angela said that Charlie's father, Herbert, had managed to crawl to the phone and called the operator. Officers picked up little Jessica and Melanie. Angela learned that her mom was dead, and her father was rushed to the hospital. She saw Charlie at the police station. They had him chained up, and Charlie apologized to her, and he was crying. And she said that she immediately forgave him, because she didn't feel like it was really him that did it. It's like he was possessed for a time. While Charlie was in jail, his father had milk delivered to him because the inmates were only given water or coffee. And the first thing Herbert said to Angela about her brother was, "Oh, the poor kid, he must have snapped." Charlie had a grand jury, but he wasn't convicted. He was in jail for 5 or 6 months, and then he went to the state mental hospital. From the Indiana State Mental Hospital, Charlie went to live with his father in a new apartment the father had gotten in Fort Wayne. So he'd been away from the family for about a year, and he was released from the asylum, and the doctors told the family that there was no threat that he would ever act out again. They described Charlie as compassionate, friendly, and willing to do anything for anyone. So looking back, we'll see that this was a big mistake.
Well, we're going to talk about not just this case, but some other case in the near future where teens who murdered a parent were institutionalized and then let out with the assurance that they were cured.
Yes,
They're not. And then I don't know how you can ever say this child is cured. He's never going to kill again.
Well, yes, and Angela would admit that she never really felt right around him. She could never really trust him again, of course.
Well, no kidding. I mean, he was going to kill her. He would have if his gun still had bullets.
Absolutely he would have.
Or at least he would have shot her.
He might have gone on to kill the little girls. We don't know.
No, we don't. Herbert recovered from his wounds. He then took a year's leave of absence from work and moved his family to Ormond Beach, Florida. No one in the family had any counseling, mostly because Herbert didn't believe in it. Angie believed that this tragedy basically ruined her life. I could see where it would.
Yes.
So she went from a straight A and B honor roll student to getting D's and F's. And then when she was 16, she quit high school to take care of her little sisters, Melanie and Jessica. She got her GED, and she got a job.
Well, let's think about this, Dick. I mean, it wasn't just that she went through this horrible trauma, but she's lost her mother.
Right.
And her mother was pretty much term, about to have another baby.
Yeah, she was ready. I mean, she was at term. She was at eight months,
yeah.
Right.
So I could see how it would ruin your life at that age. How are you going to continue as normal? You can't.
I don't know. And then no counseling because Dad didn't believe in it.
Yes, I'm thinking Dad wasn't very warm, not a talker. So who did she really have to talk to? It seems like she didn't have anyone to talk to.
No. Well, she had her younger siblings, but they were so much younger than her.
They were pretty much babies, though. Yeah. They were 2 and 3.
So that's not anybody she's going to talk to.
No, that's not going to help. It was 1973 when Angela was living with her future husband, Jim, and she told him about her mother's murder and the attacks on her and her father. And you could tell she hadn't really dealt with it. It was hard for her to tell him. She really broke down to talk about it. And he didn't believe it at first because he'd met Charlie. But then he saw the gunshot scars on Herbert Brandt's back. So he had to believe it. But Jim anyway set what he knew aside, believing that Charlie was changed. I mean, after all, he was only 13 when this happened. And these two men became friends over the years.
Well, yeah, and Jim didn't know Charlie at all when he was young and did these things.
Well, no, but
I mean,
still.
All he's got to go on is how he and Charlie interact at the present time.
Well, he knows what Angela told him about what Charlie did, though.
Yeah, but he's looking at this guy and saying, yeah, he seems like a nice guy.
Okay. I don't think I could be that forgiving. I couldn't let that go.
I don't think I could either, but Jim did.
No, there's just a thread of denial going through all of these people, isn't there?
Yes.
I mean, it was something that really wasn't talked about. And even when they talked about it, it was just the thing that happened or the incident. You know, nobody called it what it was. Some therapy probably would have been really good. But later, Jim would recall times when he did see a glimpse of Charlie's dark side, but those times he chose to set it aside as well. I mean, for example, Jim took Charlie to his mother's house in Daytona for a visit. And over dinner, Mrs. Graves, Jim's mom, said that she had heard from a neighbor about a local news story where a 13-year-old girl's head had been found inside of a paint can in the city of Astor. And right at that moment, Charlie burst out into maniacal laughter about this horrible thing. And it really sent chills down the spines of Jim and his mother.
Well, yeah.
I mean, why would someone laugh at that? And it wasn't just a chuckle. It was a big crazy laugh. Like he enjoyed it. He wanted to hear about it.
So after his stay at Jim's mother's house, Charlie moved in with his friends, Jim Elbers, known as Jimbo, and Loney Wiener. And they all lived on San Juan Avenue in a big house in Daytona Beach. They described themselves as a happy little family of hippies, and they all lived upstairs in the three bedrooms. They turned the bathroom into a fish room for storage and built furniture together. Loney remembered that Jim Graves had told them about the dinner when Charlie burst out laughing about the head in a paint can and about how creeped out he was. But they all brushed it off as, oh, that's just Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
So Loney suspected that maybe that evening had been the reason why Charlie had had to move out of Jim's mother's house.
Sure.
I think that's plausible. Maybe based upon Jim's mom's knowledge of Charlie's past, plus Jim's own suspicions, Jim had suggested Charlie move out of his mom's house and into Loney and Jimbo's.
Yeah, so Jim had told his mother about Charlie's history.
Did she know about this before she talked about the head in the paint can?
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
Charlie worked as a maintenance man at a condominium complex while he was attending Daytona Beach Community College and still living with Loney and Jimbo. Charlie liked working there because he could leave school early and then he could fish in the afternoons. So every day he would fish alone in between school and work. Loney said that Charlie would bring home fish that he caught every night for their dinner. Now, she never remembered Charlie having a girlfriend. He was gone fishing a lot. He would be up at 6 a.m., go to school, come home, get his fishing gear, and leave again. Loney did remember that Charlie did a lot of fishing when he was in Osteen.
Yeah, Charlie sounds like he led a pretty solitary life.
Well, he liked to spend time alone, but he did have
friends.
People in his life. Yeah.
But I get the impression that he didn't interact with others that much.
I don't know, Dick, because he was supposed to be a pretty friendly guy.
Yeah, but you had to approach him.
Maybe. Well, and he ended up marrying a really outgoing person, which seemed to kind of balance him out, so that was probably helpful.
Right. So Charlie took Jim on a fishing trip to the Florida Keys. Now, this was after Jim and Angela had broken up, so the marriage between Jim and Charlie's sister ended in divorce. On this fishing trip, they were drinking beer, smoking a little weed, and Charlie listened as Jim cried and complained about women and relationships. Now, so Jim's throwing out ideas for revenge when things took a horrifying turn. Charlie, who'd been silent as Jim tore his sister's name down, looked at Jim's face with a knife in his hand and asked, "You know what the perfect revenge is, don't you? Perfect revenge is you kill somebody and then eat their heart."
Yeah, Charlie seemed dead serious and Jim was very uncomfortable.
Whoa.
Because, you know, Jim was talking about stuff like how to get even with an ex-girlfriend. Not violence or cutting anyone's heart out, you know.
Well, Charlie had
maybe keeping her albums or something, you know.
Yeah, it's not the same wavelength.
Not at all. But still, Jim continued to believe that Charlie was deep down a good guy. It was another thing that he let slide.
Well, again, you mentioned there was a fair amount of denial.
Yes.
Going on.
And these things are kind of far between. I mean, if you something weird is said one year and it's a year later, it doesn't make you think that someone's a sicko. It's not like it's happening every day or every week or even every month.
Right. But at the same time, it still happens enough that you keep remembering things.
Exactly. Well, and in hindsight, of course, all these things are really going to pop out at you.
Yeah.
Charlie had graduated college in Daytona Beach and he had an electronics degree. So he ended up getting a job with Raytheon, which is the U.S. defense contractor. Jim had graduated from the School of Music at the University of Miami and was living in South Florida, and he was playing in a band. Charlie would fly the guys in and out of West Palm Beach when they had time. And after Angie left him, Jim went through a period of partying and kind of playing the field. But Jim's band broke up and then he moved back to Daytona. One day, Charlie came over to Jim's and told him, "I'm quitting my job in the Bahamas." By this time, Jim was dating a woman named Nancy Carney, a pretty blonde who was working at the radio station. Charlie told Jim he lived in some sort of military-like housing that Raytheon was providing for the employees. Charlie had been out there fishing on the flats for bonefish, knee-deep to waist-high in the water, when he said that he bumped against a duffel bag full of sealed kilos of cocaine. Charlie had all this money then, so he moved to this fancy town of Astor. Astor's kind of rural, it's north of Orlando, and it's by the St. John's River. It's a really popular vacation spot for people who like to hunt and fish, like Charlie. But during this period, Jim said that Charlie was really drinking like a fish and spending tons of money.
So Charlie did not do the right thing and turn these drugs over to the authorities.
No, but do we really believe his story anyway? We don't know where he got that cocaine. He could have just been a drug dealer.
I guess he could have.
He could have been. We don't know. But according to Charlie, he'd hidden the duffel bag of coke in the mangroves back on Andros Island, and he just took out little baggies at a time to get cash. But when he found a buyer for a bulk of the cocaine, he got close to $500,000. Jim said he never had the exact figure, but he knew that Charlie's house cost over $250,000 and that Charlie had paid cash for it. And Charlie had not inherited any money, he wasn't a saver, so the money definitely came from the drugs.
One would surmise, right?
Yes.
This guy doesn't have a job where he would have $250,000 in cash lying around.
No, do any of us? If people do, I want to know what that job is. It's not podcasting.
Oh, I thought you were rich.
No.
Oh, man.
I know. Good thing you married me for my looks.
For your intellect, baby.
Oh, that's even better.
Absolutely. So Charlie came to visit, and he asked Jim if he knew of any girls he could introduce him to. So Jim turns around and asks his girlfriend Nancy if she had a friend who would go out with Charlie. And she did. So they went on a double date to a place called the Ocean Deck. This was a party place on the boardwalk in Daytona Beach, right on the ocean. Jim and Charlie met up with Nancy and her girlfriend and roommate at the time, Terry Helfrich, for drinks. Terry had curly blonde hair, was cute, and very outgoing. Charlie seemed to like her right away. So they all laughed and drank, and they had a great time together.
Then Nancy had moved back to Daytona Beach after working for Club Med for about 2 years. She met Terry at an aerobics class, and they became friends. When Nancy was looking for an apartment, Terry had a two-bedroom and offered Nancy one of the rooms. Terry had been born in Japan at the Tachikawa Air Force Base where her father was stationed while he was in the Army Air Corps. Then he transitioned to the Air Force. Terry was a really fun person. When her older sister Mary Lou had a daughter named Michelle, Terry was very excited to be the fun aunt. So Michelle and Terry became very close. When Terry graduated from high school, she came to live with her sister and her husband, and at this time Michelle was in the fifth grade. Terry decided to go to a business college, Jones College, in Winter Park, Florida. She attended the college for a year, and when Bill and Mary Lou moved to Longwood, Florida, Terry lived with them during her first year of college. Terry finished college out of state, but she returned afterwards, and she lived with her sister Mary Lou and her brother-in-law Bill until 1977. And that's when she went to work at an upscale department store in Central Florida. She transferred to the store in Melbourne, and after 1 year, she became the store manager in Daytona Beach, and that was in 1984. So every step of her career was bringing her closer to Charlie Brandt.
So Terry was managing all the departments at the store in Daytona Beach when she ran into Nancy at an exercise class. Now at the time, Nancy was working at a radio station and was dating Jim Graves. Jim and Nancy set up Terry and Charlie on that blind date in 1985. And it was truly love or attraction at first sight.
They hit it off, yeah.
So they dated a few months, and then Terry and Charlie moved into an apartment together. Mary Lou's first impression of Charlie was that he was very laid back and soft-spoken. And he and Terry seemed to complement one another. So we have this kind of reticent, quiet guy with this really bubbly, outgoing girlfriend.
Yeah.
They worked well together.
Everybody thought they really did. Around Mother's Day, Mary Lou and Bill went over to Terry and Charlie's apartment for a dinner, and they brought along their daughter, Michelle, and also their younger son, Sean. Charlie and Terry got married with Jim as the best man and Nancy as the maid of honor, but they didn't invite any other family. And Charlie told everyone at that time that his mother had died in a car accident.
Well, yeah, it's probably not a good idea to say, oh, I shot her and killed her.
Yes, but I mean, there has to be some honesty there.
Right.
When Charlie first told Jim that he was going to propose to Terry, Jim had told him that he had to tell Terry about the incident, about murdering his mother, shooting his father, almost shooting Angela. But Charlie at first said there's no way he was going to tell her. But Jim said, you know, if you don't tell her, I'm fucking telling her. So Charlie told him, don't worry, I'll tell her. But to this day, nobody really knows if he ever did tell Terry.
Yeah, we got conflicting stories on this.
Yes, there's no proof that he did.
No.
Although some of the things she'd say later might lead you to believe she knew.
Right. Although they are kind of ambiguous things that she said. So could be that she knew about it, that Charlie had told her, and maybe not.
Well, and maybe he'd put a spin on it to make it seem not as bad.
So after they got married, the couple moved down to Big Pine Key, part of the Florida Keys. Terry got a job as a receptionist at a dentist's office. Then she went to work at the Little Palm Island Resort in their human resources department. And Charlie went back to work and ended up running the drug interdiction blimp in the Keys. So that's what he was doing in the Bahamas.
That kind of work,
yeah. That kind of work.
Yeah.
So now he's doing it in the Keys.
But they seemed to have a good life, and they were very lovey-dovey. They would actually pack each other's lunches because they both said it always tasted better when someone else made your lunch, especially the one you love. I don't know whether to feel warm or nauseous.
Well, if you take it totally out of context, just that they made each other's lunches, you'd say that's sweet.
It is sweet.
Okay.
And I do think food tastes better when someone else makes it. I don't know about someone you love making it, but...
Just anyone else. I don't care.
Anyone makes it for me, I'm happy.
Yeah. So Jim wasn't sure whether Charlie had ever told Terry about the winter when Charlie was 13. But after Terry came to him with some other concerns about Charlie, he was certain that he must have. Otherwise, Terry wouldn't have been as worried as she was.
Maybe.
Maybe is right.
So about 5 or 6 years after Charlie and Terry were married, Jim was playing with a band called Sauce at the grand opening of a place called Hammerheads out in Key West. Jim still had Charlie and Terry's phone number, so he called them up and invited them to come in here and play. As Jim was playing his guitar, Terry and Charlie walked in and sat down. On his first break between sets, Jim went over to their table, and Charlie got up to go to the bathroom. So Terry looked at Jim, and he noticed that she looked terrified. She grabbed his wrist. Jim now was in a good mood and had plenty to drink. Charlie, who was mainly a beer drinker, had to go to the bathroom a lot. He returned to the table, though, before Terry had a chance to really talk to Jim and tell him what was on her mind. When Jim's next break came up and Charlie headed back to the bathroom, he went over to the table and asked Terry, "What's going on?" Terry told Jim that she was thinking of calling the police on Charlie. She said she'd come home early from work the other night and found Charlie in the fish cleaning room. She said that both Charlie and the sink were covered in blood, but there were no fish in the room and no sign of any fish anywhere. She said a woman had been murdered a block down from their house, found mutilated in a rowboat.
So she's thinking that maybe her husband might have had something to do with that.
Yes, and I think she said something about, well, knowing what happened before, which led Jim to think she knew about the fact that he'd killed his mother.
Right. But nevertheless, Jim wasn't very helpful with her.
He wasn't.
He told Terry, don't throw away your marriage over this far-flung incident. Wow. After all, Charlie had been in a fish cleaning room and he did go fishing a lot. So no matter that there weren't any fish to be found.
Well, you know, people don't want to believe this. It does sound kind of far-fetched. Do you think your husband murdered somebody?
Right.
But if you really thought about it, you might think, well, gee, he did murder someone before. Might not hurt to look into it. But his whole thing was, oh, you're going to ruin the marriage if you do that. He'll be mad at you.
Yeah.
Which was a weird response.
That's totally weird.
Of course, he had been drinking, but even so, why wouldn't he call her the next day and talk to her about it?
I know. Then before he could do any more talking with Terry, when he did take another break, she and Charlie had already left. So he didn't have any time after that initial discussion to talk with her.
Yeah, so who knows what was going on there.
Right. So let's take a short break here for our sponsors.
Lorena Bobbitt, Amazon Prime Video and executive producer Jordan Peele bring you the new docuseries, Lorena, a Sundance official selection that shares Lorena Bobbitt's side of the story and investigates the headlines and press coverage 25 years later. The story was irresistible. Guilt or innocence would come down to whom the jurors would believe. What did he do to make her do something like that? The defense says the years of abuse put her over the edge, and this ended up being a true battle of the sexes. What it meant back in 1993 is really not that different from what it means today in 2019. Beneath the tabloid headlines and talk show jokes, there was something far more complicated. The scandal you know, the story you don't. You can watch this new 4-part docuseries, Lorena, which is streaming now on Amazon Prime Video. I recommend it.
If you're struggling to get a good night's sleep, you got to try a Purple mattress. Purple mattress will probably feel different from anything you've ever experienced because it uses this brand new material that was developed by an actual rocket scientist.
This isn't like the memory foam I'm used to. The Purple material is both firm and soft at the same time, so it keeps everything supported while I still feel really comfortable. Plus, it's breathable to help keep you cool. Try it for 100 nights risk-free, and if you're not completely satisfied, you can return your mattress for a full refund. It's backed by a 10-year warranty, plus you get free shipping and returns.
You are going to love Purple. And right now, our listeners will get a free Purple pillow with the purchase of a mattress. And that's in addition to the great free gifts they are offering site-wide.
Just text BREWERY to 84888. The only way to get this free pillow is to text BREWERY to 84888. That's BREWERY to 84888. And message and data rates may apply.
On September 2, 2004, Hurricane Ivan hit the Caribbean, killing 68 people. Then its path was headed straight for the Keys. So emergency management officials issued mandatory evacuations. Michelle Jones, who was Terry's niece, worried and kept a close eye on Ivan's track on the local news. Now Michelle, at this point, was 37 years old and working as a successful sales executive with the Golf Channel, which has its headquarters in Orlando. She owned a spacious home with a pool and a jacuzzi. For her age, she earned a hefty salary and was able to afford to buy her first home in 2002. It was a 4-bedroom older house, but it had been remodeled with hardwood floors and light-colored decor. Mary Lou would describe her daughter Michelle as a very happy child, a joy to be around with a lot of friends. When she was little, she was in the Brownies. She went to elementary school in Orlando and a Catholic school for a year.
As a high school teenager who wanted to earn her own money, Michelle babysat, and she managed her money really well. When she turned 16, she worked at some of the stores in the mall. She went to summer school every year because she wanted to graduate early from high school. And very impressively, she graduated when she was just 16. She went to high school with her best friends, Debbie Wheeler Knight and Peggy Ann Waters Moore. Michelle attended Valencia College for a year until her two friends graduated, and then all three of the girls went together to the University of Florida in Gainesville in 1984. Michelle was really driven to succeed, a lot like her Aunt Terry. After Michelle finished her associate's degree, she went to work for the local Fox network as traffic manager. So she was responsible for communications and for scheduling the commercial spots. Michelle stayed with Fox until 1994, until she was recruited by a more major network. So she'd worked really hard to build her career. She had to be very social and persuasive in her job. And she insisted that her Aunt Terry and Charlie wait out this hurricane with her. They'd have fun, she said. They would make dinner and drink wine together. Michelle's aunt and uncle had stayed with her before, after Hurricane Jorge, which did significant damage to their home in 1999. Terry and Charlie had also stayed at Michelle's for a week in 2000 while their house was being worked on. So every day for a week during that visit, Michelle fixed breakfast with Terry. Then she'd get dressed for work and come out of her room smiling in her high-heeled shoes and her tailored suits. And that week, every evening, she returned from work and shared dinner and wine with her guests. Michelle was really comfortable with her aunt and her husband, Charlie.
Yeah, so with this invitation, Terry packed a couple of bags and drove her Subaru over the 7-mile bridge that connects the Keys to the Florida mainland. Ivan had reached a Category 5, but his strength and path were fluctuating. So Charlie and Terry arrived at Michelle's house on Saturday, September 11th. Now Charlie called his father, Herbert, and the younger sister, Jessica, to tell them they had arrived and to make plans for a visit. Orlando's just a little over an hour's drive from Ormond Beach, where they lived. So Charlie and Terry made plans to see them that weekend. So they got to Herbert Brand's house at 2 p.m. on Sunday. They visited, drank beer, and then went over to Jessica's house for dinner. At Jessica's, Charlie repeatedly told Terry that it was safe to return to their house in the Keys the next day. He wanted to head home on Monday, he said. There's kind of an odd urgency in his tone.
So this makes me wonder, was he fighting an impulse to do the murders that he ends up doing? I think we'll talk about that when we get to the end of the story here, see what you think. Charlie called his older sister Angela from Jessica's house. Angela wasn't able to go to Jessica's, so she asked if they could meet the next day. But Charlie said that he and Terry had plans with Michelle, so they'd have to visit her another time. Looking back, both Charlie's father Herbert and his sister Jessica would say that they noticed that Charlie held each one of them a little longer and tighter than he normally would have before they said goodbye that day. Like maybe he knew this was it.
Possibly. So after that visit, Charlie and Terry left to go back to Michelle's. And they stayed there on Monday also. So this surprised Terry, because Charlie had been so insistent on leaving. So she's a little bit surprised and annoyed because of his earlier complaints about wanting to get back to their house. The hurricane had bypassed the Keys by then, but Charlie wanted to stay one more day.
So all of these are signs to me that he was planning what he does, what he ended up doing.
I think so. And your comment that he was fighting those kind of inner demons.
Mm-hmm.
I think is correct.
I think so. I think maybe that's why he wanted to get out of there. But then once he got there, he decided, oh no, I give up. I'm going to do it.
Yeah, maybe they should have just left from his sister's house.
Well, sure. Of course. Looking back, we can say that.
But because that's how it seems. Once they got back to Michelle's place, his plan fell back into place.
Yeah, because he was obsessed with her.
Yeah.
It was all about her, really. It wasn't about Terry.
It wasn't. So Michelle and her friends always thought Charlie was a bit eccentric. But she said that he and her Aunt Terry made a good pair. Michelle loved her free-spirited aunt, who was fun company, and Terry and Charlie were nothing if not adventurous. Charlie was a good-looking guy, kind of in a beach bum sort of way.
And Charlie called Michelle his Victoria's Secret, but not to her face. He told some male friends that he called her that because she was beautiful and looked like a model in the pages of a Victoria's Secret catalog. Creepy.
Very creepy.
On Wednesday, September 15th, Michelle's mother, Mary Lou, was becoming very worried. She'd made multiple calls to Michelle, which had gone directly to her voicemail. And this wasn't like Michelle not to return her mother's calls. Michelle had three very close friends, and these other women that were her friends were married. Michelle was the only single one. But Mary Lou called one of Michelle's friends, Debbie Knight, who lived close by. And she asked Debbie to go over to Michelle's house and see if she was okay. She was getting worried. Mary Lou told Debbie that someone from Terry's office had called because Michelle didn't show up at work. That's alarming.
Very alarming. I mean, this was a job that she loved and she needed to be there. And she was not just the coffee girl at the Golf Channel.
No.
She was a
career woman.
A force.
Yes, right.
So it would be distinctly unusual for her not to be at work without having phoned in a reason for not being there.
Right. Now, Debbie didn't want to alarm Michelle's mom, but she hadn't heard from Michelle either. And Michelle hadn't answered any of her messages or emails. Michelle and Debbie had actually been talking a lot because they were supposed to fly to Vegas together later that week. So they'd been making plans. So this was totally out of character. Debbie had a key to Michelle's house and she agreed to go over and check on her. Michelle and the friends all had keys to each other's houses. Michelle had invited her friend Lisa over for dinner, but Lisa was running late and called Michelle to tell her. And Michelle told Lisa not to bother then, telling her that Terry and Charlie had a lot to drink and were arguing, so it was no fun, so don't bother coming over. So now it's Wednesday, and Debbie called Lisa in a panic. She had a really bad feeling about Michelle. So Lisa agreed to meet Debbie over at Michelle's house. And the first thing that Debbie had noticed was that Terry and Charlie's SUV was in the driveway, blocking the closed garage door. So they assumed Michelle's car is in the garage. As Debbie got out of her car, her mind was really flashing into these terrible scenarios. And she thought maybe they died of carbon monoxide poisoning or some other freak accident. So Debbie went to the front door with a key that she thought would fit Michelle's front door. But she was shaking by this time and she couldn't get it to fit. At this point, Debbie didn't even know if she'd brought the right key. So she banged on the door with both hands and called out to Michelle. Then she ran to the family room windows and started banging on those. Then she ran to the side of the house, squeezing between the hedges to get to Michelle's bedroom window, and she banged on that window. Nothing. So by this time, she's paralyzed with fear. And she doesn't know why, but she has a bad feeling. It's dark, she's alone, she doesn't know what to do. She ran to the neighbor's house next door. Debbie started banging on their door and screaming for them to help. But it was dark inside and no one was home. Then she ran across the street to another house. That's when she saw someone walking out of the next house's garage, and she ran over to ask that man for some help. I'd like to take a short break here just to let our listeners know about Parcast's new Crimes of Passion podcast. Each week, Crimes of Passion looks into what happens when true love meets true crime. Because love is patient, love is kind, but sometimes love can be deadly. Many couples may look happy, but we don't always know what happens behind closed doors. Crimes of Passion is great in how it analyzes the relationship dynamics and the psychology that leads to betrayal and even murder. New episodes come out every Wednesday. You can listen to the first episode on Wilma Hoyt right now. And look for upcoming episodes on Amy Fisher and Joey Buttafuoco, Lorena Bobbitt, and Jodi Arias. Just search for and subscribe to Crimes of Passion wherever you listen to podcasts. Or you can visit parcast.com/passion to listen today.
So Debbie is at this neighbor's house and explaining the situation, and the guy seemed to be pretty nervous. He ran over to his car with Debbie following him, took a gun and flashlight from his car, and both he and Debbie ran across the street. He tried to open Michelle's front door with Debbie's key, but it didn't work for him either. Debbie begged the neighbor to break a window to check on Michelle, but he refused. He walked to the back of Michelle's house, then to the garage and looked through the garage window. Debbie looked through it too, and the neighbor pushed her away so hard that she fell to the ground. The man had not wanted Debbie to see the horrible sight in the garage. He called 911 to report that there was a man hanging dead in the garage. Then he told the operator something about multiple deaths. Police arrived, and just about the same time Michelle's friend Lisa arrived. So the police pushed Debbie and Lisa back to stand across the street and began surrounding Michelle's house with yellow tape. Paramedics arrived along with more police cars and fire trucks. So Debbie and Lisa were told that Terry and Michelle had been found murdered in Michelle's house. They knew that it was a particularly disturbing scene when two police officers came out of the house and promptly vomited.
That's a bad sign because these were experienced police officers. So it had to be something really upsetting in there. Inside, the detectives had found Terry Brand slumped over a living room couch, covered in blood. She had been stabbed 7 times. Michelle was in her bedroom lying on the bed. She had been stabbed once in the chest. She had been decapitated, and her head was placed sitting beside her body. Her heart was cut out, and her breasts were severed off, and also placed on the bed. Her intestines were deposited in the trash bin in the bedroom. So this goes beyond murder. This is mutilation.
It goes beyond murder and beyond dismemberment.
Yeah, and it's kind of set up to make a certain kind of scene.
Sure sounds like it.
So horrific. I can't even imagine. And I just think it was so lucky for her friend that she didn't walk in and find that, because she would never be the same. I mean, losing her friend is one thing, but to see that, how would you ever get that image out of your mind?
I don't think you could.
I do feel bad for the officers that had to come upon it, though. It's a horrible thing.
Detectives Rob Hemmert and Bob Janes had never seen anything like this. Michelle's panties and bras were all shredded with the same knife and strewn about the room. They were all Victoria's Secret brand. So this raised the question of whether Charlie had been through her underwear before, and that was the reason why he called Michelle Victoria's Secret.
Makes sense to me.
Good point. So detectives concluded that after stabbing his wife Terry with one of Michelle's kitchen knives, Charlie Brandt had spent a long time with Michelle. Investigators spent 2 days examining and inventorying Michelle's house. When they checked the FBI database, the MO of the killings matched exactly that of Sherry Parisho in Big Pine Key. Sherry was a homeless former beauty queen who was found about 1,000 yards from Charlie and Terry's house. She had been killed and eviscerated under the Big Pine Key Bridge, which was just a few blocks away from the Brandt house back in 1989.
Well, there'd also been a similar crime in Miami-Dade County, plus 26 others with the same ritualistic characteristics. Investigators found Charlie hanging in the garage. It looked like after he was done with what he did to Michelle, he'd showered and changed into clean clothing. He was wearing a white polo shirt and blue shorts. Then he found a long white bed sheet, got a metal stepladder, and hung himself from the rafters.
After learning about what had happened, Angela Brandt came forward with a secret the family had kept hidden since 1971. So the Brandt's house on Big Pine Key had been left boarded up meticulously in preparation for the storm. Charlie had taken this task to the extreme. Every piece of wood that was cut for each window looked like it had been custom fit. The holes for the doorknobs on the French doors were precisely cut. Inside the house, things were just as well kept. But investigators were shocked when they looked in the master bedroom. On the back of the bedroom door was a graphic medical poster of the female anatomy.
It was super creepy. In the poster, the woman's hair is up in a bun, which is a new one to me. I've seen a lot of medical posters. I've never seen that. But it shows the muscular and skeletal systems. Terry would have seen this poster every day, and we can't help but wonder what she thought about this. Neither Charlie nor Terry were in the medical profession, so there was no reason for that chart to be there. Did she think this was no big deal, or did she kind of know that he was a sicko? I don't know. But I can't imagine sleeping with that thing on my bedroom door.
No kidding.
Next to this man. It just gives me chills. Even if you didn't know about his history, I would not be okay with that. It's very weird.
Very, very weird. But there were other eerie findings, including medical books, journals, and an anatomy book. And in the anatomy book, there was a newspaper clipping that showed a human heart. So knowing what he did to Michelle, and then finding these things in his home, things started to come together and make some sense.
Well, as much as anything like this could make sense.
Right.
It's so crazy.
Yes. So there were also Victoria's Secret catalogs found in the house, addressed to Charlie. So far from being a friendly uncle, Charlie had actually been secretly obsessed and sexually attracted to his own niece.
They had no idea. We don't know if Terry knew anything, but Michelle clearly didn't know.
Right, she did not.
I mean, her friends and her parents said there's no way she'd put up with any of that. When investigators examined Charlie's computer, they found that he'd been on some really horrible websites, too, that featured death fantasies, necrophilia, and some really extreme violence against women. To detectives, it was a certainty that Michelle had not been the first woman that Charlie had killed. This looked like someone who'd done this before. It was very meticulously done, very planned out. So they expected to find some evidence that Charlie was a serial killer. And the only real question was, how many other victims had there been? We've had over 30 years here for him to do this, between the killing of his mother and the killing of Terry and Michelle. So to try and answer that, police tried to match their unsolved murders with Charlie Brandt's travels in the United States as well as abroad. Potential cases were weeded through to find specific similarities to Charlie's murder of Michelle. Because the murder of Terry was pretty much just to get her out of the way, I would think. It was just a brutal stabbing.
Well, he did her first so that he wouldn't be interrupted while he was dealing with Michelle.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
But this is like a horror movie type of
thing. Isn't it? Yeah.
Criminal profiler Leslie D'Ambrosia was asked to analyze dozens of cold cases and see if they matched Charlie's M.O. because his trademark was precision and a very methodical technique. How a person normally behaves is usually reflected in how they carry out their crimes, too. And Charlie was very organized and planned out everything. But still, to the outside world, he was just an ordinary guy. Terry's diaries that were found in the house reflected a pretty ordinary life. She'd written nothing about suspecting Charlie of being a killer.
There were a couple of interesting notations, but these were just like weird day type of stuff. Nothing more specific. She did note some times when Charlie had been out late, even out all night, but never added any explanations.
I'm just so curious about what Terry knew or suspected. There had to be something going on in her head about this. She was a smart woman.
Yeah, but why would she stay with him?
I don't know. It's a mystery.
Yeah.
If maybe she was just suspicious, and we really will never know.
We won't. I would have to think if she had more tangible proof, she wouldn't have stayed with him.
I don't think so. But you know how people can really have a hard time believing this sort of thing about someone they care about. She was married to him
for
years.
This is her husband, so she thinks she knows him.
She's been married to him for years. She's in a relationship with him. He's been kind to her, as far as we know, never violent or anything. So why would she think he would be doing that?
Good point. We'll never know.
Right.
So one other thing about Charlie that was disturbing is that he was a very well-traveled person. For years, he had traveled all over the United States and even outside the U.S. So given that more than 30 years had elapsed from the time he shot his mother till he killed his wife and niece, it's unlikely that these were his only crimes.
No, but detectives don't think we'll ever know how many murders Charlie was responsible for. In the search for unsolved murders that fit his profile, there was one case that immediately jumped out at detectives, and this was the 1995 murder of Darlene Toler. She was a prostitute in Miami's Little Havana section. Detective Pat Diaz, who handled this investigation, remembered that this was a very unusual case. Like Michelle, Darlene had been decapitated and had had her heart removed. Darlene's body was found along a highway. Apart from the manner of her death, two bits of evidence point to Charlie as her killer. Her body was wrapped up in a blanket and then wrapped up in plastic and tied up almost like a package. And in that blanket, there were some dog hairs that were found. Police also found dog hairs in the back of Charlie's truck that were very similar. And his truck also had another clue. Every time he put gas in his truck, he kept a record of the mileage. And in those mileage records, a spike occurred right around the time that Darlene was killed, and she was killed 100 miles away from his house. So that fit.
Yeah, but then there was another murder, much closer to the Brandt's home, which fit the pattern even more. This was 17 years prior, the summer of 1989, and it was just four blocks from Charlie's house. And we've talked about this or alluded to it. Under a bridge off Big Pine Key, fishermen discovered the body of a woman, and this was 38-year-old Sherry Parisho. She's the local woman who lived on a small rowboat. She had a bicycle that she put on the bow of the boat, and she'd take her boat out about 100 yards offshore. Now, investigators believe that was where she died. For years, the boat had been locked away in the evidence yard. In the wood, there are visible cutting marks, which led detectives to believe that the bottom of the boat was used as a cutting table. For years, all police had to go on was a sketch of a man who witnesses saw running across the highway near the scene. Until Charlie's former brother-in-law, Jim Graves, revealed what Terry had told him just after Sherry's murder about finding Charlie in the fish room covered with blood and no fish in sight. So Jim Graves said he later confronted Charlie And he said, you know, your wife thinks you might have committed this heinous act. And Charlie said, I didn't do it. So Jim just let it drop.
Well, yeah. What else? That's good enough for me.
Yeah, you say you didn't do it. Okay.
All right, Charlie. Well, understandably, Michelle and Terry's family members are angry that Charlie was released after murdering his mother without any treatment or punishment, really. 13-year-old Charlie was never diagnosed with a mental illness, but he was released to his father with no follow-up. It's never been determined what set Charlie off to kill his pregnant mother and attempt to kill his father and his sister Angela, but there was clearly something wrong with him. But psychiatrists where he stayed on the psych unit really couldn't find a diagnosis for him. So I guess they just decided he's not mentally ill and let him go? I really don't understand.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they think it was some kind of impulse kill.
Well, I mean, a lot of serial killers don't have a mental illness per se, right? There's something wrong with them. They're killers.
Yeah, but they might not have a psychiatric diagnosis.
Exactly. And I think that was the case with Charlie, but I don't think that means that you just send him home.
No.
No.
So there are over 26 murders that have been considered as the work of Charlie Brandt. One of these was the disappearance of a 12-year-old Volusia County girl whose head was found in 1978. And this is the head in the paint can.
Right.
When Charlie was laughing his maniacal laugh.
Right, that's the one.
So Angela would admit that she never really trusted Charlie after he killed their mother. She kept him away from her own children.
Well, how could you trust him anyway, right?
Right.
Records from his brief stay at the psych hospital haven't been released because Herbert wouldn't give consent. He's kept this family secret. And I don't know after Herbert's death if they can be released. If it would be up to Angela or somebody, I'm not sure if we'll ever be able to see those. It's been so long, who knows if they even have them. Things like that can get lost.
Well, they can. But at least at some point they were still there because the father refused to release them.
Exactly. But I would imagine the father's quite elderly. I wonder who has the power of consent at that point when he passes away.
Right. Maybe Angela does.
Maybe. Although she's not really wanting to talk about it much either.
That's for sure.
It's such a disturbing case that this man spent his life killing and he was never caught. Also, disturbing that after he committed murder at age 13, they just sent him home, pretty much. I mean, a year? Big deal. Now, generally, looking at the Indiana Juvenile Code, a killer of 13 years of age would be held in juvenile detention until the age of 18, and then there'd be a hearing and they would determine the next steps.
But that wasn't done with Charlie.
No, and I'm really not sure why. Unless we have an Indiana lawyer who knows and wants to share it with us, we really don't know.
That'd be good.
But it's just...
But it might be that the psychiatrist had a lot more power, and he said, this child is okay, he won't do this again, and he got released.
It could be. And it was the early 70s. I'm hoping things have changed since then.
Right.
Right?
Grizzly.
Yes, it really is. It's a fascinating story, but just horrendous. And my heart really goes out to Michelle and Terry's family.
Every hour in the United States, 75 people are reported missing. What if there was a task force dedicated to bringing them home? That's the story behind the new original drama, Gone, premiering February 27th on WGN America. It stars Chris Noth and Danny Pino, as well as newcomer Levin Ramin. She portrays the newest member of this elite team who is a survivor of a childhood abduction herself. Don't miss the series premiere of Gone, Wednesday, February 27th at 9 o'clock Eastern, 8 o'clock Central on WGN America.
The music for True Crime Brewery is written and produced by Tristan Capel. If you need more TCB in your life, you can go to our website, tigrabber.com, and join Team Tigrabber for access to members-only episodes. Along with your exclusive access to members-only episodes, you'll receive a gift from us. You can also get these same benefits by going to Patreon, looking up Tigrabber, and becoming a patron. This month we covered the murders of Sheila LaBarre, a real sociopath, and she killed and tortured young men on her New Hampshire farm. Next month, in March, we're discussing the crimes of Robert Reldan. Reldan took years to be caught, partly because of the support he received from a rich aunt, and partially because he often changed up his M.O. If you enjoy the show, We would really appreciate it if you would take a moment to give us a review on iTunes or wherever you listen, because that helps us find some new listeners. We're going to move on with our feedback segment now. Just remember, you can send feedback and case suggestions to us in an email to truecrimebrewery@tigrabber.com, or you can tell us in your own voice by leaving us a voicemail. You can do that on our Leave a Voicemail link on the front page of our website, tigrabber.com.
So here we have some feedback. I got kind of an abbreviated feedback section today. The first voicemail is from Allison, and she has a case suggestion.
Hi, I love your podcast. My name is Allison. True Crime Brewery is awesome. I wanted to recommend a case which took place in New York City, and it was the murder of an actress named Adrienne Shelley, who was this darling, sweet actress who had some kind of construction workers in her home, and something happened, and I guess I won't say what happened, but if you could look into it, I would love to know more about that case. I feel like it never really got much publicity, and it was pretty shocking. So again, her name was Adrienne Shelley, and I think the movie that she was in was called The Waitress, and she was this beautiful, sweet actress, and she was just at her home in the West Village, and she was murdered. Okay, I love your podcast. It makes me really happy to, I know most of the cases, so it's like from my true crime addiction last year, I watched most of them on YouTube, but I love rehearing the cases through your storytelling. It's wonderful. And that's it. So thanks again.
Well, thank you so much, Allison. Allison has a very seductive voice. She has a great voice. She could have her own podcast. So what do we know about this case? I know that Waitress is one of my favorite movies with Carrie Russell, and I'll have to look and see what role she played in that movie, because I did really like that movie a lot when it came out.
Well, Adrienne Shelley wrote the movie.
Mm-hmm.
She directed the movie, and she co-starred in it. So she was a big force in it.
Yeah, and it's a really good movie.
I just did some brief stuff to look up. I know we'll probably want to investigate a little bit more. But Adrienne Shelley, that was her stage name. Adrienne Levine is her real name. Her birth name. So on November 1st, 2006, she was found dead hanging in the shower of her Greenwich Village work studio apartment. Now, the initial examination didn't reveal any suspicious circumstances, and police apparently believed it to be a suicide. However, her husband insisted she would never have taken her own life, and this brought about a re-examination of the bathroom. There they discovered a footprint, and it turns out that a construction worker who was working in the building confessed to killing Shelley and making it look as if she had killed herself. Her husband established the Adrienne Shelley Foundation, which awards scholarships, production grants, finishing funds, and living stipends to artists. And in her honor, the Women Film Critics Circle gives an annual Adrienne Shelley Award to the film that it finds most passionately opposes violence against women.
Excellent.
So we'll check into that.
Yeah, I'd like to know what the motivation was. What happened there? Was this a sex crime? Kind of sounds like it.
Does.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks again, Allison.
Then I have another case suggestion from Nicole.
Hi, Joe and Dick. This is Nicole from Vancouver Island in Canada. I absolutely love listening to your shows. I join you at the quiet end almost every day. I have to say that your voices are very soothing, though, because I've had to go back and re-listen to a lot of the shows because I've fallen asleep at night with my headphones in. So, I do love your beer reviews as well, Dick. I've actually started making a list for my husband because he loves trying different beers. I have a case suggestion for you. It is the Wells Gray Provincial Park murders in British Columbia, close to Kamloops. A man called David Shearing, initially, he now goes by David Ennis. He killed an entire family, and they were initially missing, and then they found the burnt out car in the park, And there's actually quite a lot of information on it if you look up the, if you do a Google search on them. Just a quick overview. It says David Shearing killed a family of six in August 1982 while they were camping in the Clearwater Valley near Wells Gray Provincial Park, about 120 kilometers north of Kamloops in BC. So there is actually a CBC.ca, the Detectives Episode 1, Season 1, is dealing with that also. And there's quite a lot of news reports on that as well. So I think maybe that might be a really interesting show for you guys to have a look at. It kind of, the fervor about it died down quite quickly. That was my, I was quite young when it happened, and that was my initial kind of explosion with true crime and started getting my mind working, and I like to try to figure things out and try to find out what makes these people tick. And that's why I love the amount of research that you both put into doing your shows. So I think that if you guys wanted to have a look at that one, I think that would make a great show for you guys. Anyway, thanks again for all the work that you do. And we'll see you at the quiet end again soon.
Thank you, Nicole.
Yeah, no, this is like a 35-year-old case, but it was kind of interesting that he killed a mother and father, their two children, and the mother's parents.
Jeez.
They were all out camping or doing something. It was just a horrible crime.
Yeah.
So we'll check that out.
Okay. Yeah, she explained it very well.
She did. Thank you, Nicole.
Thank you. So I have an email I'm going to read from Emily.
This is Emily. She has a comment.
Emily says, I'm from Toronto, Canada, so I definitely have heard a lot about Russell Williams. An interesting fact is that he went to the elite boys private school called Upper Canada College, UCC, which is a very prestigious private school in Toronto. UCC is known to be a school with a very macho environment, and lots of kids from other schools don't like the boys there, as they find them to have a bit of a jerk attitude. Also, during the time Russell Williams was there, I'm pretty positive that sex abuse and molestation were going on. Now, some men have admitted to this. This summer, my mom saw the girlfriend of a man who held a high position, maybe vice principal, I'm not sure, at the school my brothers and I went to. My brother was also in the same grade as this man's son, so my mom knew them a little bit. My mom asked the girlfriend how this man was doing, and she admitted he was not doing well and has gone on a disability leave. My mom, of course, was really surprised and asked why, and the girlfriend said that he had PTSD and was really suffering. She told my mom that he was abused when he went to UCC, the same school as Williams, and most likely they would have been there at a similar time. It was triggered by the school giving training about sex abuse. So an interesting fact about the environment at this school in this time period. Still, in the last decade, students have come forward to admit that they were abused by other students in forms of hazing rituals. So not really a good environment. Okay, well, thank you, Emily. That's an interesting comment on one of our more well-known cases.
Yeah, I wonder if that had an effect on him, if this was going on at the school while he attended. And we know what a creepy individual he turned out to be.
Well, yeah, there is some evidence that sexual offenders have been sexually abused in the past.
Right.
A lot of times. So. Yeah. Plus, there's definitely the macho environment, which I feel is kind of prevalent through a lot of the military anyway.
Oh, sure.
Especially if you're getting up to be a bigwig like Russell Williams was.
That's right.
Yeah. He did seem very cocky in the interviews they did with him.
Cocky and privileged.
Yes, right? Absolutely. Like he thought he was smarter than other people as well.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that was an interesting email.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much. And thanks to everyone for your feedback. We really appreciate it.
We love hearing from you.
Absolutely. That wraps it up for today. And we'll meet with you again next week at the Quiet End.
See you there.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye.